Hello, this is Richard Alabown on webtalkradio.net, talking about Paranormal is Normal. This week I'm going to talk to Rupert Sheldrake about his new book, The Science Delusion, but mainly about why paranormal is normal. His book has proved to be a great contribution to science and the way it is done, because Rupert asks pertinent questions about areas of science that don't add up to scrutiny, and about the whole way that science is carried out and funded. Rupert also asked pertinent questions about why the paranormal is not accepted in any way by science. So let's now meet the man himself, Rupert Sheldrake.
Hello.
Hello, Rupert. It's Richard Alabown.
Yes.
And it'd be nice to talk to you about your new book. Well, it's nearly 3 months since it was launched, The Science Delusion. And I expect you've been very busy since.
I have.
It's caused quite a stir, I suspect.
It has, yes. It's also been selling very well.
Mm-hmm. I've read it fairly carefully, and I'm very, very fascinated with a lot of things you said. I rather think the term whistleblower is apt. Perhaps you don't like that as a description, but you have taken the lid off the scientific setup at the, you know, which is quite something. Nobody's ever done it before, I believe.
Well, people have looked at various aspects of the dogmatic foundations of the so-called scientific worldview. And they, you know, people have looked at the sort of mind-body problem, or at the taboo against psychic phenomena, or at the memories in the brain and that kind of thing. But I haven't come across any systematic attempt to examine the entire dogmatic structure. And of course, my aim in examining it is not simply polemical. I'm not just trying to say it's wrong. What I'm saying is it's too limiting and science can move on. So really my aim is to try and liberate science from this, or help liberate it, and so that things can move on and science can become more curious and scientists will feel freer.
Yes. I like the word freer, but I believe the book is going to be retitled in an American version, Science Set Free.
That's right. Here in Britain, it's called The Science Delusion, Freeing the Spirit of Inquiry. So this thing of freedom is a key part of it. The reason it's changing in America is that my American publishers thought that The Science Delusion could be misunderstood there. First of all, Richard Dawkins, whose book The God Delusion is obviously a kind of model for the title here, isn't so well known in America as he is here. He's very well known in atheist circles, but otherwise not so well known, so most people wouldn't get the illusion. And then secondly, there's a big anti-science movement in America, you know, the creationists, the climate change denial, and so on. And they were afraid that it would be mistaken as a kind of anti-science tract, whereas that's not what it is, really. It's dealing with science, trying to open science up, not simply attack science.
Yeah. Yes, and now the book is in fact, deals with 10 different dogmas of science, and the last two are the ones that particularly interest me, of course, telepathy and healing.
Yes.
Perhaps we could talk about the telepathy bit first.
Well, what I'm doing really is, in the book, I take the dogmas and turn them into questions. And the dogma in this case is the dogma that psychic phenomena are illusory. That's the kind of more or less default assumption of most people in the academic scientific world. Or at least it's the kind of official view. A lot of people don't agree with it, but it's the view that people pay lip service to in public. So what I do is to take a look at that view and show that, first of all, it's a dogmatic point of view, and it follows from the belief that the mind is nothing but the brain, the materialist assumption. If the mind's nothing but the brain, then all mental processes and activities must be inside the head. Therefore, attention and intention can have no effect at a distance, nor can future states of mind. So telepathy and precognition are ruled out a priori. They must be illusions. They can't possibly happen. So that's the reason for the taboo. And in the previous chapter, I look at the mind and the brain theory and show how limited it is and how it doesn't really fit with the facts. And then I go on to look at the evidence for telepathy and, to some extent, presentiment and precognition. And I think the evidence is really strong. And what I show also is that in my debates with skeptics, including Lewis Wolpert and Richard Dawkins and others, people who defend the standard taboo, the most notable feature of these debates is that they know nothing of the evidence and don't want to know. It's a position based on ignorance and on a kind of arrogant assumption they already know the truth. So really that's what I'm doing. And of course I summarize the evidence for telepathy as I see it.
Yes, of course the skeptics, they daren't look at the evidence because it would make them look foolish. So they have to say, well, you know, I can't be bothered or I just don't know.
But they don't usually say, I can't be bothered or I don't know. They usually say there isn't any evidence.
No.
They usually make much more categorical statements. You know, Richard Dawkins says things like the paranormal is bunk, and Lewis Wolpert says there's no evidence for anything, any person, animal or thing being telepathic. And when I had a public debate with him, it was clear, very soon clear to me and to everybody else, that there was a lot of evidence, but he simply didn't want to know about it. So, but so he made the claim there was none.
Yes. One of the claims you make is that most people have some sort of telepathic experience during their life. I find that a bit surprising, really, because, you know, I know that quite a high percentage of people, well, maybe 50% or 30%, I don't know, but I feel that the use of the term most people is perhaps a little bit strong, to be honest.
Well, I've done surveys myself, and so have other people. And the commonest kind of telepathy in the modern world is telephone telepathy. Mm-hmm. If you ask people, and they think telepathy means having a dream of somebody who's just died, or having some tremendously dramatic message about someone who's had an accident. These dramatic kinds of telepathy, it probably is a minority of the population, maybe 20-30%. But if you ask questions, have you ever thought of someone who then telephoned in a way that seemed telepathic, then something like 80% of the population say yes. And I've done this in surveys, and I've also done it in lectures and seminars. And I've never got less than 80%. Even when I gave a seminar at the European Molecular Biology Laboratory to a whole room full of molecular biologists who were, you know, in the very hard core of reductionist science, it was about 80% of them had had this kind of experience with phone calls. So I think if one widens the question, I think, you know, try it out with your friends. Anyone listening can do that. Bring the subject up amidst a group of friends or family, you know, at dinner or in a pub or something, and, you know, say, have you ever had this experience? And I bet you that in most groups of people, most people will say yes and start telling stories about it, because it is really very, very common.
Yes. Yes, I suppose you're right. But I have a problem in that my son is vehemently against any idea of telepathy. I tend, because he's my son, I tend to view him as a typical Englishman, so I found it, I was rather surprised that you said most people, but when you, as you say, you have asked groups of people to put their hands up, it does make a point, I'm sure. Yeah.
Yes.
And then, of course, you've gone on from there to do properly organized scientific tests of telephone telepathy, showing positive results of millions or billions to one.
That's right, and anyone who wants to in Britain or America can do the test for themselves, because I now have an automated version running on my website at the online experiments portal of my website, sheldrake.org. So anyone who's interested can actually try this for themselves.
Mm. Yeah. Yes, in fact, I looked at your website last night, sheldrake.org, and I was amazed to see you have a large thing right at the beginning, paranormal is normal, and which is nice when one, and if anyone would like to click on there, then there's various videos that you've produced on various aspects of your work, which is...
Yes, that's a new venture of mine. It's called Sheldrake TV. It's run by a company called Miovi, and what it is a subscription service where I answer dozens and dozens and dozens of questions in sort of 2-minute video clips, and it also has a kind of interactive component. So this is a new kind of internet venture. And it's not been done in the English-speaking world before. It's based on things that have been happening in Germany. Anyway, that's what that's all about. And there is a link to it from my website. And anyone interested can try the thing out for free. You sign up and just give in your name and email address, and then people can have a free trial and see if they like it.
Yes. Well, there are several which are free anyway, just as a sort of taster, which...
Yes.
Which I watched last night. Yes, which is quite good. Back to the science delusion. The bit that really interested me in your book was the way in which you were converted, if that's the right word, to a belief in telepathy by Sir Rudolf Peters many years ago. Perhaps you could just outline what happened then.
Yes, well, it wasn't exactly conversion to telepathy. What it was an opening of my mind to telepathy.
Right.
I was working in the biochemistry department of Cambridge University. I was doing research there. I was a research fellow or a graduate student, I've forgotten which. I was in my 20s. And I'd absorbed all the standard prejudices. And somebody mentioned telepathy, and you know, I dismissed it along with most other people in the biochemistry tea room. You know, it's just an absurd superstition. But Sir Rudolf Peters, who was the retired professor of biochemistry from Oxford, said, "Oh, well, I'm not so sure." He said, "I've looked into a case and myself, and I think the evidence is pretty good that it really happens." And then he told us about this case, and I was interested, and he gave me a copy of his paper on the subject, which he'd published in the Journal of the Society for Psychical Research. And essentially the case was a friend of his was an ophthalmologist. He tested a boy with severe learning difficulties who was almost blind. And when he did standard eye tests, he found this boy was getting results from reading out letters from a chart much better than he should have done, given his very poor vision. So he thought maybe he was doing it through the mother. So he sent her out of the room, and the boy just simply couldn't do it. And the mother wasn't telling him, but he worked out there must be something like telepathy going on. So he told Peters, and the two of them set up tests where they showed the mother cards with numbers or letters on them. And the boy was at first separated by a screen, so he couldn't see the mother, and she didn't say anything. And he could pick them up. And then they did it over the telephone with dramatically impressive results. And they'd published a paper on this, and they thought that this case of very remarkable telepathy had grown up because the mother wanted to help the son, and it was the only way that she could... it was one of the ways in which she enabled him to function more normally, and he'd simply become telepathically attuned to her. In a way, to a much greater extent than most children would with their parents. So, anyway, this was the case that Peters had investigated and told me about, and I looked at the evidence and I thought, well, you know, this is very impressive, and this man is an honest, decent man, and a very eminent scientist. And you know, the evidence is more interesting than the denial of it on the basis of ignorance and prejudice. And that really made me feel much more open about the whole subject. And until then, I'd taken very little interest, none at all, in fact, in it.
Yes, I found that very interesting, yeah, both the actual case itself and the fact that it opened your eyes, changed your attitude, which was the important thing at the time. And I'd like to raise one more thing about telepathy, which I read in your book that you, as a child, you used to have lots of pet animals and so on, and were interested in animals, and particularly, and also pigeons. And where you were living, they did a lot of pigeon racing. Now, I'm here looking at what they call the world's premier pigeon racing weekly magazine, called the British Homing World.
Yes.
And in it, this week, there is an article, which in fact I've written, and it says, "Learn how pigeons find their way home." And I decided that, as you and I know, pigeons are probably telepathic, and they will be able to tell what's going on at their home roost if they're away. And when they're away, they will be watching the sun rise and set, which is a thing which all the animal kingdom is tuned to. And having done that, they're then able to find the difference between the sunrise where they are and where it is, and the sunrise at their roost. And this gives a measure of the distance they are from their home base. And as far as I can make out, nobody's ever thought of that one before.
No, I don't think they have, Richard. I mean, I've followed this literature for years, and I think that's a new one.
Well,
but let me tell you why I'm a bit skeptical of it.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, it would predict that pigeons couldn't home unless there were some pigeons left in the loft.
Oh, yes.
And usually there are some left in the loft, but in pigeon races, but not always. And, you know, that's an easily testable aspect of your hypothesis. If you take all the pigeons away from the loft and then get them to home, your hypothesis would predict they wouldn't be able to do it unless at least one is in the loft.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Secondly, pigeons can home on cloudy days when they can't see the sun. Because in the 1950s, the predominant theory in the 60s was by a chap called Matthews at Cambridge, who said they did it by sun navigation. And his theory was tested by seeing whether they can home on cloudy days. And also the Swiss Pigeon Army Corps trained pigeons to home at night. They don't normally fly at night, but they could be trained to do that. So that rather meant that the sun may play a part under some circumstances, but it's not the sole key to the thing.
No, that's a fair comment.
So those are arguments that might militate against it.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, the telepathic, if telepathy has a directional component, which I think it does, then there could be an additional aspect to your telepathic hypothesis over and above calculating the sun's position and the latitude and longitude, which is that, you know, when in the so-called psi trailing cases, when people, say, move to a new home 100 miles away, they leave their dog behind. And the dog finds them, turns up a few weeks later, and you know, exhausted and emaciated, but finds them in a new home. There are quite a few cases of that, which suggests not only is there a bond between the animal and the person, but it's directional, because it enables the animal to find a person far away.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't do it by just sniffing along scent trails. Sometimes when people move by flying or taking trains, the dogs can find them. They couldn't possibly track them by scent trails.
Yes.
So yes, that implies a telepathic, a directional component. So if on your hypothesis, I would think it, if one's going to have a kind of telepathic hypothesis, I'd think it at least as likely that there was a directional bond between the pigeon and another pigeon in the loft,
yes,
as that it was done by a telepathic communication of sunrise and so forth.
Mm. Yes, well, it could be that that is part of it. It may be one or the other. One aspect of this is that they discovered that if they have lights on at night in the pigeon loft, in the home loft, then the homing tends not to work because the pigeons in the home loft are not attuned to sunrise and sunset. So that I find with a little bit of research. So that gave me some support in my idea. But anyway...
That's okay. Yes, that's interesting. Let me just add one more thing about pigeons, that my own hypothesis is a bit like yours, that they have a bond to the home position, the loft itself, rather than pigeons in the loft, a kind of directional connection, which is a bit like a stretched elastic band, so that they feel a pull towards the home, rather than sort of calculating it from the sun. But otherwise, it's not unlike your own hypothesis.
Mm. Yes, anyway, it's nice to think about these things. Yeah. Now, and the other one of the scientific dogmas which you questioned is the one about healing. You say, is mechanistic medicine the only kind that really works?
Mm.
And you talk about placebos and so on. But I was a little disappointed in that you were not able, of course, to comment very much on actual healing itself. Because, of course, there isn't the scientific quantified evidence that has been able to get with telepathy tests.
You mean things like faith healing?
Yes, that's right. Mm. I mean, I know you mentioned faith healing, but it's much more difficult to get a quantified result that one can say, yes, this healing did work.
So, well, that's true. I mean, it's true of every even conventional medical research. It's hard to get clear-cut results. I mean, people run clinical trials on new drugs, you know, double-blind, placebo-controlled trials. And they're very expensive. You have to do large numbers of people. The results are statistical, and they're not always clear-cut. So it's very hard to get any kinds of results, even in orthodox medicine.
Yeah. Yes, I suppose that's true.
And that's one reason I don't do any kind of medical research. The other one is that I'm not a doctor, but a medical doctor. But it's terribly hard to get clear-cut results in any kind of medical research.
Yes, yes, and I do appreciate that. And that, of course, is why you don't say very much about it in your book.
That's no, my main point there is that in that chapter is that all these different healing systems seem to work, and the main way that one could do research is through comparative effectiveness research, comparing how different methods work for treating common ailments. Mm. And just not based on the assumption as at present that the only one that can really work and that ought to be funded is mechanistic medicine, but say, well, you know, for chronic skin complaints, let's see what does best, mechanistic medicine, homeopathy, acupuncture, naturopathy, you know, whatever, and just see what works in a theory-neutral kind of way.
Mm. Yes. Now, there have been some tests trying to establish that with laying on of hands and so on, there have been tests done, but of course the skeptics are able to fire in and say, well, there could be other reasons why the person was healed, whereas with telephone telepathy, it's either yes or no, so one can be much more positive.
Yes.
Yeah. So there we are. Yes, it was very interesting reading your book, and I'm sure that people in America will, when it comes out in September, I believe.
Yes.
Science Will Be Set Free in America.
Mm.
I think that's a wonderful title.
Yeah. Good. Well, thank you.
Yes. Well, thank you very much, Rupert, for
pleasure, Richard.
Chatting to me today. We'll get this in my program for next week.
Good, thank you.
Right. And your website again for people to...
Sheldrake.org, www.sheldrake.org.
Yeah, and there is a mass of information there on all sorts of things. One of the ones that interests me particularly is the Nolan Sisters video, which was done a good many years ago.
Yes.
Of a group of young ladies who used to be very well known in this country anyway. I'm not so sure about the rest of the world, but I expect they did travel. But they were able to give a very good demonstration of telephone telepathy.
Yes, indeed.
Yes. Okay, well, thank you again, Rupert.
Okay, right. Goodbye.
We'll meet again. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You will have noticed that Rupert Sheldrake has done more research into homing pigeons than I have, but it was good to share our views and to discuss the evidence, which is the important thing. And it's the evidence for the paranormal which allows us to say paranormal is normal. Over the years, Rupert has studied telepathic animals and has shown that highly significant results were obtained with dogs and a parrot when tests were done using a scientifically acceptable protocol. In his book, he gives the results of his well-known work on telephone telepathy, all making the point that there is no possibility that telepathy is an illusion. But one of the 10 core beliefs of most scientists is that it is an illusion. Another core belief is that the use of medicine for healing ailments is the only one that really works. Paranormal healing is only an illusion, they say. In his book, The Science Delusion, he questions these 10 core beliefs of science, of which only two I have mentioned here. Look at his website, sheldrake.org, and see some of his videos on Sheldrake TV, he calls it, titled Paranormal is Normal. I hope you enjoyed listening to Rupert Sheldrake today. This is Richard Allibone signing off on webtalkradio.net. Bye for now.